Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Please check us out at SoundCloud, and please go to Reason.com and hear all of our podcasts, watch all of our videos, and read all of our news, commentary, and analysis about politics, culture, and ideas from a libertarian perspective. Today, we're talking just a couple days after the presidential election, which ended with Donald Trump being named president. I'm joined by Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
She has a bit of a sore throat from either crying or, you know, being in one of those big Trump rallies. We're also joined by Reason senior editor Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Associate editor.
Well, you know, you blew the surprise, but.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so now you guys, I'm talking from Ohio. You guys are from various walled neighborhoods in D.C. I want to ask this. Is this, and Catherine, why don't you start, is this good or bad for libertarians to have a President Trump?
I think on balance, I'm going to say bad, but I also think it is a total wild card. We really don't know whether President Trump is going to wake up on, you know, February 1st and listen to libertarians who are indeed lurking in his circle, or whether he's going to wake up on February 1st and say, my first priority is the child care tax credit, my second priority is Medicare Part Q, and my third priority is war.
Well, you know, I would consider it a win if his third priority is war, but yeah, he has spoken so widely, and I'll remind people that we covered Trump during the at Reason TV. We followed him around a few times, and at the anti-Iran deal rally that took place over the summer, I guess it was, because I remember it being hot, but I actually got close enough to him to ask a question as he was exiting the stage, and I said, you know, what do you think about libertarians? And he looked at me, and, you know, at that moment, I felt like I had x-rays going through. He had his resting bitch face on, and he kind of smiled and said, you know, libertarians, I like them. I like a lot about it. And then I said, like what? And he literally pushed me away and said, I don't want to talk to you right now. And so, you know, I take that as, you know, who wouldn't take that as an optimistic sign? Liz, what do you, you know, what do you think from a libertarian perspective? Is Trump, you know, a train wreck on steroids, Amy Schumer on steroids?
I mean, I think that much is obvious, but yes. But also, I kind of tend to share Catherine's view a little bit. We were together for a bit on election night, sort of watching the results come in. And we actually seem to be the two in the room that, while we think, I mean, not to speak for Catherine, but she just sort of said, you know, while it's clearly going to not be a libertarian gain, it's not going to be as sort of uniquely well, we don't know. It's a wild card, but it doesn't necessarily going to be as uniquely catastrophic as I think a lot of people are immediately knee-jerk convinced it's going to be.
Yeah, well, talk about that. Why, you know, and I understand if you're a traditional conservative and a never Trump conservative, this is your worst nightmare, partly because you were beaten. If you're a progressive or a more traditional centrist Democrat, this is a utter shutout and a shock to the system. But why do so many libertarians seem to be freaked out by Trump? And I ask that not because there's anything objectively good about him. I mean, he's terrible on almost every issue that we care about. But why do people think he would be worse than Hillary? Catherine, what's your sense of that?
So I think it's partially, it's a little bit of an echo chamber problem. You know, libertarians here in D.C. Do hang out with the press corps generally. And so that means liberals who are freaking out. At the same time, I do think it feels familiar to be full of despair after a presidential election. Like, the morning after is always bad for libertarians. No libertarian has ever woken up after election day and been like, oh my God, the brave new future that we face delights me. So it feels kind of normal to me in a way that I maybe didn't fully anticipate. And I was braced for Hillary, which was already, I was sort of anticipating an onslaught of a slightly different variant of awful statism. But I think libertarians are going to be able to grapple with this more quickly because we're used to the despair.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that was my sense of things is like I was driving, you know what, I'm about to commit a journalistic cardinal sin by bringing in friends of my my children as points of wisdom. But one of them.
I thought you were going to say your taxi driver.
Yeah, no, I only use Lyft driver. I've even moved past Uber drivers. It's only Lyft drivers now. Yeah, I want to get to sidecar, but I'm not even sure it's still in business, right? But no, one of the kids, because in my neighborhood in Ohio where I vote, I'm one of two people on a very short street that have Johnson Weld regalia up. And, you know, everybody knows what I do. And so one of these kids, he's a sophomore in high school. He was like, how do you feel? You know, my parents were crying last night and they were Hillary supporters. And I was like, well, you know what? It's kind of great on election day to be a libertarian because you know you're going to lose. But you might eke out some, you know, this is kind of like Charlie Brown's All-Stars. If you score a run, you know, and get blown out, you know, 100-1, you've still, you know, you've had your best showing in years. So I'm always kind of optimistic after Election Day. But Liz, what is your sense? Like, do libertarians just love the apocalypse, or is it kind of like that they're aping or grokking, you know, their friends who might be conservative, might be liberal, might be gold bugs or something, you know, just that kind of end of worldism?
I've seen a lot of libertarians be pretty calm about it. I mean, I've seen plenty, yes, be exactly like everyone else about it. It's kind of fun, a little bit like you guys were kind of saying, is that like everyone kind of gets the feel, or at least a lot more people get a feel like libertarians generally feel on like the morning after election this year. Just like, but I mean, yeah, if you're not ever expecting anything, it is like there are some bright spots. And also I think just, I don't know, I'm a lot more comfortable than most people in maybe media or punditry just not knowing and thinking that's an okay thing to say. And that's kind of where we are with Trump right now, just because there is, I mean, on policy, on whatever, like we just don't know. And so it's, I don't know, the bright spot is that it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing this morning, though, and this is people are joking about this because people are already talking about how he might sort of pull back on Title IX stuff, which is, you know, the campus sort of sexual harassment and sexual assault stuff, and how he might pull back on funding on that. And there's like indications of that. And everyone's like, oh, of course, you know, he wants to end sexual assault investigations. But as, you know, we often write about Reason, that office is actually really terrible and is doing really terrible things. So that's one small positive, possibly.
All right. I totally understand. Well, this gets to a question of what is the role of reason, Catherine, in an age of Trump? You wrote a piece that'll be the editor's note, of course, in the upcoming issue of Reason, where you kind of sketch that out. What you know, and I can remember doing this as print editor as well. Every time there was a new president, and God damn it if it doesn't happen almost every 4 years, but it's you got to write that. And but you wrote, I think, a really lucid statement of what is Reason's position in, you know, when a new president is elected.
You know, one thing that Reason is going to wind up always saying, no matter who gets elected, is, hey, people on the other side, remember when you thought expanding executive power was such a great idea? How are you feeling about that right now? And I think that's really happening right now. We had 8 years of Obama where people rushed to shove into his hands any power they could think of, and he grabbed what they didn't want to give. And everyone said, well, that's okay, because he's using it for good stuff. And frankly, even libertarians did this a little bit, for instance, with his immigration orders. We said, oh, we don't like the form, but we kind of like the conclusion. But for the most part, I think libertarians were pretty principled on this and consistently said, you know, power grab to the executive are not on balance a good thing for liberty. And now it's like, oh, that big pile of treasure that you accumulated, go hand it to Donald Trump. And suddenly people on the left are like, you know, maybe balance of powers has something going for it.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see, though, if a Republican Congress can or even tries to reassume any of the powers that have, it's kind of abrogated to the president.
Yeah, and you know, it's particularly one person I'm watching because I actually believe he is a principled, serious constitutionalist is Mike Lee of Utah, who, along with people, other serious constitution believing senators like Rand Paul and Jeff Flake, has created a group that he called, or it's more or less called, the Article One Project, where his whole goal is to reassert the primacy of Congress under the Constitution as the place where laws are created and where wars are declared. And he wants to rein in the executive branch to what it should be, according to earlier understandings of the Constitution. And of course, Lee was not a Trump supporter. He did not go totally balls out and, you know, being anti-Trump, but he did not really endorse him. He comes from Utah, which was, you know, made Trump earn a victory there. And it'll be interesting to see if Mike Lee, now that Trump has won and there's a Republican Congress, if he is still pushing to restrict and restrain the chief executive. Do you think we'll see that any kind of friendships growing among, say, progressives or liberals, Liz, who under other circumstances might you know, who otherwise might be, executive privilege is great, you know, or executive authority, expanded executive authority is great. Do you think that they'll actually think and look towards libertarians, or will they kind of be lost in their own wanderings?
I mean, I think that's when I was talking earlier about like things that could be good. I think that is maybe one thing that we can at least look forward to being a possibility, is that, yeah, this makes us have a lot more common with the left again, who, you know, tend to be sort of routinely awful during when they're in power. And we might actually get to see some sort of, you know, reconsideration of these things, which is sort of shitty that we have to, you know, do it under these circumstances. But in any event, it might be nice to, you know, the problem will be, you know, sort of avoiding. I hope that libertarians can avoid doing that, like, I told you so. I mean, we should have a little bit of that, but we're on the people by sort of gloating.
Yeah, by dint of being libertarian, we're on the spectrum. So I think the answer to that is no. Of course, this is, you know, we're doing an end zone dance in like the cheap seats out in the parking lot, but we will try to restrain the I told you so's. Liz, you wrote a an excellent piece on why Hillary lost that you put up, I think, yesterday. Talk a little bit about that, because, you know, not surprisingly, a big amount of the focus has been, how did Trump win? How did Trump animate this unknown army of, you know, of sleeper agents who are racist and homophobic and hate women, et cetera? How did he animate them to the polls, et cetera? What you did was focus more on, you know, what happened to Hillary, and what did you find? Why did Hillary lose this election, which, you know, had been promised her since sometime in the late 70s, probably, and, you know, in the back room of Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, Arkansas?
Right. That's what I thought was very interesting, is that as soon as you started looking at, and I know exit polls are, you know, sort of unreliable. At this point, they've sort of congealed into a sort of semi-coherent picture. And what it shows is that, you know, it was a very low voter turnout overall. There wasn't some massive surge of new voters who came out to vote for Trump. There wasn't even some sort of massive new segment of voters or huge new voting block that, like, switched Trump. In large part, electorate looks a lot like Mitt Romney's did, with very small increases amongst African Americans by like 1% over Romney, maybe 2% more Hispanic voters, and some more working class whites. But on the whole, Hillary still got way more you know, lower income voters, way more female voters, way more people. Got them in lower numbers than Obama did. Not drastically lower numbers, sometimes only 1 or 2% lower. She actually got 1% lower with women than Obama did. Sometimes as much as, you know, 5 or 8% lower, though. And that's what did it. Not that there was any new surge of Trump voters, but that the reliable sort of Democratic voting blocks and the Obama coalition of voters that drove him just didn't come out in the numbers for Hillary that or to get over the amount of traditional Republican voters that were voting for Trump with these slightly small increases in these other voting groups.
So there was no, you know, surprisingly, when the two major parties elect the two most hated candidates in human history, voters don't come out in large numbers. They stayed home.
Right.
And Hillary, you know, in a battle between, you know, two horrible candidates, a douche and turd as South Park has, you know, the selection, if nothing else, gave them kind of a week off a season off because they could just dust off their 2004 theme. But that it didn't bring people out in large numbers. And Hillary failed to motivate her base even less than Trump was ginning up energy. Why do you think, Catherine, why do you think Hillary failed to get out the vote when, you know, this was a historic election? This was an occasion to vote in the first woman president. This is somebody who has been in the Democratic Party for 30 years, you know, in the public eye for 30 years almost, and had done all of these great firsts. What is it about Hillary that people, her own party, her own base was repudiating?
You know, I think at this stage, people are looking for structural answers like, oh, should they have had a stronger ground game or should the social media presence have been different? And this is the moment in the post-election analysis when the focus on the individuals kind of starts to fade. And I think that's what happened here. I mean, Hillary wasn't that appealing. She wasn't that appealing the last time she ran. She has a long, long history of reasons why people hate her. Trump is the same. And I think, you know, there's this very, very strong thing that Liz alludes to, that basically half the people are Republicans and half the people are Democrats. And, you know, the numbers wiggle on the edges, but it's going to be 50-50. And it's been 50-50 in nearly every American election in my memory. And so that feels like what we need to do is look at the structural level. We need to say, okay, how do you tip it so that it's consistently, you know, 52-48. But actually, in this case, I think it's just, people didn't love Hillary as a person. They also didn't love Trump. So it was just kind of a race to the mediocre, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, aren't they saying that they differed by like 200,000 votes or something? I mean, it's something really.
Well,
like,
overall, the popular vote, yeah, right, is quite close. And Hillary, right, of course, won that.
And that's telling, right? Yeah. What that tells you is that it's not, I think what it tells you is a reassuring message also, which is that nothing happened in this election that was actually an insane outlier. It feels like that to some
right.
people right now about
right.
Trump, but that's not true.
So
you see a lot of people that are, you know, kind of saying too, like, oh, the percentage of sort of working class white voters in the Midwest and rural areas that went to Trump did it because they're all racist. But if you look, a lot of them actually were Obama voters in 2012.
Right.
So I don't know what that says, but it doesn't necessarily say that they're racist. I mean, that's a weird outcome to take from that. It's definitely, I don't know, leaves a lot of room for other causes, I think.
Well, and, you know, here is one of the questions is, you know, so Hillary, you know, one thing we can say, maybe one interpretation that is probably already hardening into conventional wisdom is that, you know, this Trump didn't win the election as much as Hillary lost it. People said that about Al Gore in 2000, which was a similarly close race where he had a lot of built-in advantages, including money, including name recognition. And I know, Catherine, you and I have bounced back and forth about this. There's that great, implicit assumption that when a candidate visits someplace more often or has more contact with the voters, that will translate into more votes rather than less votes. And it's
right.
just
I mean, that is like the weirdest assumption underlying
yeah.
modern campaigns.
I mean,
if you see Hillary Clinton's face
yeah.
and hear her voice in person, has to be in person, why? No one knows. Suddenly,
yeah.
you will want to vote for her.
As
like,
if
that's
you,
not how human interactions work.
She could have possibly won my vote by saying I would never see her during the entire election season. And, you know, the minute that I say I'm going to vote for someone else, she'll be at my door. I'll be like, okay, I'll vote for you. Just stay away. But what about for me, some of the stuff that's interesting and with all the caveats about exit polls, and we're talking fractions here, But what does it say to the narrative that, you know, Trump supporters are racist, Trump supporters are xenophobic? And, you know, there's reason. Trump's language is at times racist, at times xenophobic. But he did better than Mitt Romney, who had historic lows, recent historic lows among blacks and Latinos. Is it cause for, optimism isn't the right word, or for, you know, hallelujahs or anything. But if he did better with minorities than Mitt Romney, you know, that's kind of surprising, isn't it? Because, wouldn't we expect Latinos, to the extent that we expect, and this might be wrong, to vote as a block? I mean, no presidential candidate has been more outspoken in wanting to get rid of those people than Donald Trump. And yet he did better than Mitt Romney.
I mean, I think Trump would say it's wrong to think of this as an issue about race. And while that's certainly explicitly the way that Democrats cast this election, they said, you know, we are the party who sticks up for minorities and women and gays and people with disabilities. Those people are the people that our society should be structured to help. And Trump said, I'm not going to follow your political correctness. So I'm going to say stuff that sounds racist, and sometimes it is racist, but I am also going to stick up for the people who are the least well off. It's just that for Trump, and apparently for, you know, 50% of America, the people who are the least well off are the people who lost their jobs to immigrants, the people who feel unsafe because of Islamic terror, the people who feel like they're silenced because of political correctness. He just created a different victim class. Hmm. And it's not unrelated to race, but that's not the center of gravity, right, of how he assembled that victim class.
Do you think, Liz, that and one of our colleagues, Robbie Suave, wrote a piece that was quite popular at Reason, saying, look, Trump is the response to political correctness in at all levels of American culture. And, you know, he was conjured into being, into national presence by a kind of cloud of political correctness, and he won. How much do you think his bashing of political correctness, which he brought up, in his presidential announcement in like 20 seconds, in the first debate, he said, you know, this election is about political correctness. Is political correctness a big issue? And then where does it go when you're trying to govern?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of good evidence that the Trump's emphasis on that sort of thing really helped him in the primaries and really helped rally his base. And you see the kind of you see the kind of people who probably would have been Trump voters anyways at his rallies who were really sort of taken by that aspect. And you also see maybe the creation of a sort of new, very avid class of, well, definitely the creation of a sort of new avid class of Trump fans online on Twitter and on social media and things like that. But I don't know that necessarily translated to like his victory in the presidential election, because if you look at, I mean, that those are groups that are very heavily young. And if you look at the numbers so far, like Trump didn't do any better with millennials than Mitt Romney did. Millennials still overwhelmingly went for Hillary, even though they didn't go out in huge numbers, right, of Hillary, because they didn't really like her either. So I think that when you look at who actually did go, the few people that did go for Trump, I don't think that you can say that like lower class voters in Ohio were really like cared about, you know, what Trump was saying on Twitter or that sort of thing. I'm kind of not convinced by that narrative.
Do we worry that there is and I'm thinking of some things I saw Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist at NYU, who writes a lot about how different political or ideological groups think in America. He wrote yesterday to the Democratic Party, you lost partly because of identity politics and trying to harden and reify ethnic and gender categories and sexual orientation categories. It's a bad thing. Do you think that's going to be one of the ongoing major battlegrounds between people who identify themselves in an array of groups of kind of victim classes or people at risk, people of color, people of gender, people of non-traditional sexual orientation versus the white male? Is that going to be a continuing battleground, especially in Trump's era? And is it a toxic kind of confrontation to set up, Catherine?
It is definitely going to be, because that's the frame that the Democratic Party sees the world through. And it's not a crazy frame to see the world through, right? Like, that's the thing, is identity politics are based in real experiences in the world. At the same time, I think the Republican Party prior to Trump weren't able to formulate a different narrative. So one reason that Republicans were perceived as being sort of home of racists and, you know, white privilege is because they were just saying no to the Democratic story. I'm going to be very interested to see what 4 years of leadership from someone who I think really consolidated and formulated a different version, which Democrats still 100% see as just this traditional Republican, no, we're sticking up for white people. But I actually don't necessarily think Trump does see it that way. And whether or not he will be able to convince America that his version of how to slice and dice the American public is right, I have no idea.
Yeah, and he seems to be, in a weird way, especially for the, you know, a kid who grew up wealthy in Queens and is a billionaire and flaunts his wealth at every turn. He seems to have keyed into a class-based identity that every other politician had missed in a weird way. And it might be because on the Democratic side, if you were poor, then you were a part of an ethnic minority. You weren't white. And Trump seems to default more towards that. I guess, you know, Liz, let me ask you this, and then we're going to be wrapping up. But there's a lot of talk among a lot of people, both in the media, but also, you know, who work in the media, but people of color, people of alternative genders and whatnot. You know, if you read anything, you read again and again, this, I am scared. I have nothing to protect me in Trump's America. You know, my people or people who look like me, or people that I care about, they are unprotected because in Trump's America, white privilege is back, whiteness rules. We're going to see, you know, concentration camps. We're going to see persecution. We're going to see mass deportations. Do you think that those fears, first off, are they as widespread as people in the media believe? And if they are, what are the ways to make sure that to kind of assuage people's anxieties if, in fact, they're kind of exaggerated?
I mean, I got an email from a group email from some of my college friends who are in Chicago and not at all in the media or anything, and they're sort of having those same sorts of reactions. So I think that it is not just a media thing, although, you know, you're finding a lot of it online because that's a place where people, you know,
you're right,
give voice to these things. And I don't want to diminish like anything that anyone is feeling, especially the people who are like likely to be much more likely to be affected by Trump's policies, whatever those end up being, than white, straight, whatever, Americans. But I also really, I think that it's hopefully not going to be as bad as all that. Mm-hmm. I think that as much as, you know, even if you think the worst of Trump, I guess I think better of the American people and our system of government that we would be able to stop things like that. So I guess even also, if you don't have any faith in Trump, like I guess I'm sort of an optimist at heart about that.
I also think this is kind of the inevitable consequence of a campaign that's been going on for many years now to conflate not liking to hear disagreeable words or opinions that you disagree with, to conflate that with the lack of physical safety, right? This is the term safe spaces.
Right.
This is, you know, the notion behind trigger warnings. And I think I had been a little dismissive of that, like as a problematic cultural phenomenon, but the reaction to Trump's election as people genuinely fearing for their own physical safety or the physical safety of people that they love, that strikes me as a result of this purposeful confusion. People will not be hurt by hearing mean words like sticks and stones, right?
Yeah.
And it's of course true that Trump's policies could result in actual physical coercion. And of course, at that point, every libertarian should say, oh no, remember how we always said we don't like the government to physically coerce people to do things? Okay, this is why. But until then, it really is just people saying stuff that other people don't want to hear, and we're allowed to do that. That's okay.
For me, the place that I go with this is kind of when Ted Cruz attacked Donald Trump, when it was shaping up to be the two of them left in the octagon, and he accused Donald Trump of having those New York values, that Donald Trump was, you know, he was comfortable around drag queens, and he was comfortable around Jews and Puerto Ricans and a rainbow coalition of all sorts of people in America because he had New York values and he lived in New York. And that's where it I totally understand and accept that people are scared shitless who are in categories that they think they're going to be targeted for which they're going to be targeted. But one of the things that is interesting is that Trump actually shows a huge amount of, tolerance or pluralism isn't quite the right word, but a person's race or color or gender doesn't seem to bother him. In the in one of the debates, he even said when he was asked about like where would transgender people go the bathroom at a Trump hotel, and he was like wherever they want. He seems to have blown up many of the culture war issues around the Republican set of politics, especially how people look. He's in a weird way, he's an anti-globalist, but he ran the Miss Universe contest. He likes, it's an odd phenomenon. And I agree also, Catherine, that this is a place where I think libertarians have been and will be front and center, where when the government starts going after, minority groups, of whether it's ideological minorities or ethnic and racial gender minorities, et cetera, that, this is a place where we have a long record of speaking up for the people who are in those categories. And hopefully that will carry the day if, in fact, if these things start coming online. Final question for you each. Were you happy, sad, or somewhere in the middle with the way that Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party candidate, ended his presidency? Liz, you first.
I mean, I guess it was about as expected, so I was neutral.
All right, neutral. Neutrality on the Libertarian part.
Can I tell you something real quick, though, about my parents, who are Southern Ohio swing county voters?
All right. This is almost as bad as talking about your teenage or younger children, but please go ahead.
I know.
Yes.
They were started off in the primaries as Kasich fans and then were so pro-Gary Johnson until the last minute, and then the week of the election, they decided to be to vote for Hillary. Both of them. So
wow. So are they? They're crying many bitter, delicious tears right now.
I guess, yeah. I haven't spoken to them about it yet, actually.
Well, they're in hiding, right? Because they.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
my anecdote about my parents. Sorry, just wanted to end on that.
No, that's it. I mean, that's an interesting journey to the center of of truly wasting your vote, right?
Yes,
Catherine,
exactly.
What about you and Gary Johnson?
I am glad that the Libertarian Party did respectably. I think, more than tripling your showing is super impressive. I am also selfishly, profoundly glad that they did not reach the 5% threshold so that we don't have to have a big fight about whether or not to take the federal election money, which I was not looking forward to.
Yeah, would have set back
well
the movement.
Played, Gary Johnson. Thank you, sir.
That would have set back the movement. We would have, broken down into small two or three person bands roving the libertarian landscape, fighting to the last person. Well, I want to thank Liz Brown, an associate editor at Reason and Reason.com, and Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor of Reason Magazine. Subscribe to Reason Magazine. Go to Reason.com. Subscribe. It's $15 a year. And you also get access to our back issues. Thank you both for being on the Reason podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the Reason podcast, this is Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please do go to iTunes and subscribe there for free. Rate and review us. Tell us how we're doing, what we need to do better, what we should stop doing. And also listen to us at SoundCloud and check us out at Reason.com, the website for all Reason stuff. You can watch all our videos, listen to all our podcasts, and read all of our commentary about news, politics, and culture from a principled and fun libertarian angle. Thanks so much.